Des Dearlove, and this is a Thinkers 50 podcast. My guest today is Roger Martin. Roger is Dean of the Joseph L. Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto and author of The Opposable Mind, How Successful Leaders Win Through Integrative Thinking. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Design of Business. Okay, now The Opposable Mind was very much looking at integrative thinking. Mm-hmm. Can you just remind us what you mean by that?
What I mean is that when people face decisions, they can either make them as either or and say, boy, I am now facing a decision and I would like to be able to do both, but I can't, so I have to choose one versus the other. Integrative thinking is a form of thinking that says instead of choosing, instead of saying it's either A or B, you can actually create a C that is better than A or B. And you need to train your mind to hold A and B in it at the same time so that you can construct a C rather than, as we currently do, I think, train our minds to say our job is to decide A or B.
Okay, what would be an example of that?
Well, Izzy Sharp is a fantastic example. The Four Seasons hotel chain, he faced the choice of building classic large city center business traveler hotels, 750 rooms or above, like a Hilton or a Westin or the like, or the small motel, classically a Holiday Inn or La Quinta, 150 rooms or less, a few amenities, low cost. Those were the two models of building a hotel chain. And he liked the intimacy and warmth of the little motel. He liked the amenities of the large hotel, all the conference facilities, workout rooms, etc. But he didn't like the coolness of and lack of intimacy in the large hotel. He didn't like the lack of amenities in the small motel. And instead of saying, I need to choose one or the other, he created a new class of hotels, the medium-sized luxury hotel that had such great service that guests were willing to pay enough to cover the costs of the amenities that people thought you needed 750 rooms or above to cover. And he created a form that was 250 to 350 rooms with wonderful service and intimacy and warmth. And that would be the integrative option.
Okay, so integrative thinking, you've got a choice perhaps of two, but instead of choosing between them, you pick a third, which is an even better solution.
That is right.
Okay. So you studied, I know you studied leaders, business leaders in particular, and you found this was a characteristic of effective leaders?
Yes, it was a remarkably consistent characteristic. What I set out to do is try and figure out how highly successful leaders think. And the reason I did that rather than what do they do is if you do look at highly successful leaders, they do so many very different things depending on what context they're in. And so if you were to say, boy, I like what Jack Welch did or I like what Michael Dell did, I'm going to do that too, I would argue that chances are that you'll fail miserably, not because what they did was silly, but what they did was so tied to the particular context. So I was asking myself the question, well, if we could ask, is there a pattern of thinking that enables highly successful leaders, regardless of the context they happen to be in, to make better choices, that would be interesting. So I set out to interview 55 of them, it turned out, in great detail. Typically, I interviewed them before audiences of students and came to the conclusion that this was the most common characteristic where all of them made, if you will, their great fame and fortune was a decision of that sort.
And you spoke to some very well-known leaders. I mean, you spoke to Jack Welch, did you not?
Jack Welch, absolutely. He was very lovely. And Michael Dell and A.G. Lafley and Bob Young of Red Hat fame and Chuck Knight of Emerson. Yeah. Meg Whitman. They were very generous with their time. And I was intrigued to see how much they learned about their own thinking. Izzy Sharp of Four Seasons was very gracious when I sent him the chapter that featured him. He said, oh my God, now I finally figure out how I can explain how I think. I've been trying to do that for a long time, but couldn't really figure out what the essence of it was. So it seemed to be helpful to them too.
And this has had an influence on how you're teaching the next generation of business leaders at Rotman as well, hasn't it?
Absolutely. We have revised the curriculum entirely so that students learn integrative thinking, and they learn it from upfront. The very first course they take in the fall of first year is Foundations of Integrative Thinking, where they get taught some basic patterns of thinking and model building skills. And then we cap off the first year with the Integrative Thinking Practicum, a very practice-oriented course. And then in the second year, I teach a course called the Opposable Mind that is the second year capstone course. And so we think we can produce fundamentally a different kind of thinker out of the MBA program. It's quite exciting.
Okay. Now that theme of how business people think obviously is continued in your forthcoming book, which is The Design of Business. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what I've established in The Opposable Mind, I believe, is that instead of choosing A or B, the great business leader creates a new option, C. And so what I wanted to do is, if you will, double-click on that and ask the question, well, how exactly do you do that? Because it's all well and good for me to tell students or executives come up with a better idea, but if I can't give them a way of doing that, it's not very helpful. So The Design of Business is a book about the two fundamental kinds of thinking, analytical and intuitive thinking, and the shortcomings of both in creating business solutions. So analytical thinking is about analyzing the past and extrapolating from the past. That won't typically find you a brand new solution. Intuitive thinking, kind of thinking without reasoning, isn't systematic enough for business. So you may have a creative genius who may say, well, I know the answer, but I can't even explain to you why it's the answer. That doesn't fly very well in business. The question is, can you put together the best of analytical thinking and the best of intuitive thinking into something I'm calling design thinking? And that's what and the answer is yes, and that's what the book is about.
Okay, so what characterizes design thinking? I mean, what do these people do that's different, perhaps, to analytical or intuitive thinkers?
Well, what they use is a form of reasoning called abductive reasoning. So the world is dominated the business world in particular is dominated by analytical thinking, which uses inductive and deductive logic, which are the two sort of accepted forms of logic. Deductive is the logic of what must be. Here's my rule, and so I'm going to apply the rule. Inductive is I'm going to go out and observe a statistically significant sample of things and induce an answer from that. Both of those are based entirely 100% on the past, and so you can never create the future with that. A third kind of logic is that's little understood and little taught and not used in the business world formally is abductive, which is the logic of what might be. If you see something that doesn't fit current patterns, it's the logic you use to say, what might that be? What could possibly be the case? And design thinkers, whether they know it or not, use abductive logic. So it's not intuitive thinking. It's not thinking without reasoning. It's not knowing without reasoning. It's a different form of reasoning. And how you see that in practice is they're much more interested in understanding the whys behind the what. So they'll look at consumers and say, well, why are they doing that? Let me get deeper into that so that I can suppose what's going on here, rather than saying I need to observe 10,000 consumers and figure out what they're doing. Because to do that, what you have to do is only you're going to end up considering fewer things about those consumers, because it's got to fit into a check the box, you know, kind of market research form. So they do deeper ethnographic study of consumers to try and imagine what could we give them that would be different.
So they're kind of trying to understand the underlying drivers, the underlying causes. Can you give us an example of that?
Well, an example would be, instead of, and this is work I did in the latter days with General Motors, instead of saying we're going to survey consumers and try and find out what are the 10 things they care about cars, and we're going to do this rigorous market research with thousands of them, I'm a proponent of senior executives, the most senior executives in the company, going out and doing home visits, garage visits of car buyers. And what I convinced them to do is do that. And we did that for the Malibu, the new Malibu, which has been a smash hit. get a vehicle that's taken on the Camry and the court successfully, and it's on the basis, I believe, of what senior executives were able to find out about how consumers actually used and thought about their cars and designing to that rather than designing to quantitative research. Now, it's a creative process, right? It is, you know, if you will, studying market research. Right, what has already been and what's statistically significant about that is not a creative process. Understanding consumers more deeply and saying what could we give them that they're not even asking for because they can't really articulate it, that is the creative process. Because it's creative does not mean it is completely lacking logic, which is what lots of business people think. And that's where this intermediate ground of abductive logic lays.
Okay, now there's a lot of talk about innovation these days. And in fact, I think you've said that companies suffer from innovation envy. What's innovation envy?
Well, people look at Apple, or they look now at Procter & Gamble, or they look at Herman Miller and say, gosh, we'd like to come up with something as brilliant as their breakthrough Aeron chair or as breakthrough as the iPod. And so they're envious of that. And what, back to sort of management thinking, what they don't understand typically about the processes that they utilize for thinking within organizations is that they drive out the very innovation that they envy. And a very clever turn of the 20th century American pragmatist philosopher, Charles Sanford Peirce, I think came up with something that's very, very critical for business. What he said is, you cannot actually demonstrate in the history of the world how any new idea came to be via inductive or deductive logic. Yet, those are the two forms of logic that dominate kind of academic discourse and the way people are taught to think and therefore think in organizations. He said, but because there are new ideas, there must be another kind of logic. And that logic he termed abductive logic or abductive reasoning. And another thing he said consistent with that is that essentially if you ask somebody to prove any new idea in advance, it is not doable. So when you utter the words in a corporate setting in a boardroom, well, can you prove that? The answer, if it's any new idea, is no. And if that means then it's an illegitimate idea, you will have no innovation. And that's why that at its heart is why so few companies are innovative. They say either explicitly or implicitly, prove it, not realizing that using that as your standard means no new idea will succeed.
Okay, we've been talking a lot about thinking, a lot about the way that managers make sense of the world, but fundamentally, managers are practical people, that they want to get on and do things. What do you want the managers of the world to take away from your book? What do you want them to do with this, with these new ideas?
Well, one would be to recognize that they are creative people and that it is absolutely okay to have an idea that they can't prove in typical corporate terms. So what I want them to do is go away and say, I see something that I can't entirely explain. This might be why it's happening, and this might be a way of responding to it. And then do something I call turn the future into the past. You see, most corporations are organized in terms of we need proof from the past to do something more in the future. And that's the enemy of creativity. The problem with the future for analytical thinkers is it doesn't count for anything. What might happen doesn't count for anything. So if you've got an idea, Des, that is, I think we ought to try this, the analytical thinker will say, well, how can you prove that will work? You can't. So the bad news about the future is it's illegitimate in some sense. The good news about the future is it'll soon become the past, right? with the passage of time. So the thing that I would encourage people in organizations to do is figure out how to turn the future into the past, how to do an experiment that won't cost the company its complete future, won't cost it an arm and a leg, but allows you to create some evidence that the analytical thinkers, a month from now, if you try something and it seems to work and consumers like it, it's now, guess what, in the past. And the analytical thinkers will say, oh, well, that worked. Let's do more of that. And so what I tell people in an organization, if you want to be innovative, forget prove it. Think abductively. Imagine a future you could create, and then think about how you can help all of the more analytical thinking people in your organization turn that future into the past. And that's where, rapid prototyping and doing small experiments fits into the innovation process.
Okay. Okay, and the book's out when?
The book is out October 26th, The Design of Business.
Okay. Roger Martin, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure, Ed.